Good morning. Today we get a perspective from the policy organization, the National Alliance to End Homelessness. Nan Roman gives the homeless view from the Hill. We'll also look at how an Oregon county is working on youth and family homelessness. And Hawaii Island Mayor Billy Kanoi gets his chance to respond to what we've heard this week as our look at homelessness from the outside in continues. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich.
I'm Chris Vandercook, and Kuma Kahua operates in a state-owned facility in downtown Honolulu, coexisting with a homeless community and watching it grow and change. We'll hear from Kuma Managing Director Donna Blanchard.
That's the conversation for Thursday, September 17th. Coming up next, the news.
Good morning and welcome to The Conversation. I'm Chris Vandercook. A national perspective this morning on homelessness.
Yes, that's what we're going to get. And good morning to you.
Good morning to you.
We're going to talk a little bit about the view from well over there, the view from Washington. Now, if there's one thing you know that we've learned about solutions to homelessness, it's that they're mitigated by the specific needs of the different faces. Veterans, the mentally ill and substance addicted, families and youth are just a few of the subpopulations that Strategies to End Homelessness target. Later on in the program, we'll look at the population we haven't talked much about yet, homelessness among youth and families. And as we continue our series on homelessness from the outside in, first, we're going to get a perspective from the Washington, D.C.-based policy and advocacy group, the National Alliance to End Homelessness. The nonpartisan organization provides data and research to policymakers and elected officials. Executive Director Nan Roman is on the line with us now. Good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks very much for being able to make us a part of your day. Your organization analyzes current homelessness policy and develops cost-effective policy solutions. And from your work across all the sectors, public, private, nonprofit, how do you assess Hawaii's island-to-island strategies to counter homelessness?
Well, I don't know that I'm an expert on all the strategies that are going on in Hawaii, but I would say from looking at the data that Hawaii's problem is growing, whereas nationally we've been reducing the number of homeless people. So there could be a lot of reasons for that, but one of them may be that perhaps the best practices are not being employed there or employed there across the islands.
What best practices would you specifically cite?
Well, I think what we know works to end homelessness is really to get people into housing quickly and to take a housing first philosophy or approach. That is not assuming that people who have difficulties are going to easily be able to solve their difficulties while they're homeless, and really that it makes more sense to help them get into housing faster and then help them address their problems. So that plays out differently for different populations, as you raised in your earlier remarks. You know, for families or single people who are really homeless for economic reasons, that's probably short-term rental assistance to get back into housing and then linked with services. And for people who are disabled or chronically homeless, it's a little bit more of the stereotype. Also moving them quickly into permanent supportive housing, so housing with services, and helping them address their problems once they're there. I think what doesn't work usually is thinking that people are going to be able to solve their problems while they're homeless.
We've been talking to mayors across Hawaii. Yesterday we spoke with Maui Mayor Alan Arakawa, who said that you can't go into just housing people first, that you need to give them services and that they couldn't be able to sustain being in housing by themselves, that they really need to have the services first. That's a very different story from what we're hearing from other mayors. Is it making the situation in Hawaii more frustrated by not having all counties aligned?
Well, I can't speak to the particular challenges of Hawaii, but certainly I would imagine it's better to have a common approach. I'd have to disagree with the mayor. It's not that people who are homeless might not need some services to help them resolve their crisis that caused them to become homeless, to address trauma, you know, to deal with immediate problems. They do need some services to do that. But I think that expecting it's sort of intuitive, I guess, that when people have housing or a place to live, they're going to be able to do better in addressing the problems that they have.
And that doesn't happen when people are in tent cities.
It definitely doesn't happen when people are in tent cities. I mean, people in tent cities often come up with strategies to try to help themselves and to survive. Those aren't always the most useful strategies, and they're not necessarily strategies that help them when they return to housing. Tent cities really are not places where people should be living.
We talked yesterday also with the U.S. Interagency Council on Homelessness Coordinator for the region. That includes Hawaii. Katie Miller said that she really felt that communities should be working with urgency. Those were her words. At the federal policy level, do you see Congress and the Obama administration working with urgency on homelessness?
I think we're working with urgency. We see a lot of work with urgency, on particularly on certain subpopulations. So veterans, for example, there's the federal goal of ending veteran homelessness by the end of the year, and there's a lot of urgency there. And both Congress and the administration have put resources on the table and are really pushing hard on communities. And communities are also working with urgency. So I think in that area, yes. And less so in some of the other areas, chronic homelessness, the general families, for example. There's been a little more attention to youth lately, but I wouldn't say that that's being attacked with urgency on the whole, because we're not getting additional resources. So different, you know, a little bit different story for different populations. But I think when you're looking at it from the perspective of a local jurisdiction or a state, the sense of urgency is much more important there, and it has much more effect, because you're really looking at people's lives. And people who are living outside, especially because they tend to be more likely to have disabilities, just really not acceptable. Youth who are outside are in tremendous danger, and so these problems become much more urgent.
This week, there have been some alerts from community agencies over the Transportation, Housing, and Urban Development Bill, which, among other things, also funds the Community Development Block Grant Formula Program and the Home Investment Partnerships Program. Is there a real threat in the Senate Committee on Appropriations to that funding?
There are definitely threats to the both of those programs in the congressional appropriations process. Yes, their funding levels are proposed to be low. All of the funding levels are low for the housing programs because of previous sequestration agreements that need to be changed. So really, don't have enough money in the bill to meet the needs of people. We don't have enough money, even the best of times, to meet the needs of people, but this is even worse.
So what might you project from that?
Well, I think if we end up with these low numbers, there are going to be a lot of difficulties locally because, you know, housing affordability, notwithstanding that people have people who are homeless have other kinds of problems, mental health problems, substance abuse problems, and many other physical health problems, but really, housing is the driver in homelessness. People are housed. They may still have problems, but they're not homeless anymore. And what's really driving the issue is housing affordability questions, and that basically people just don't make enough money to pay for housing. And the gap between what poor people make and what housing costs is just growing. And I know that's an extremely acute problem in Hawaii. And these programs, CDBG and particularly HOME, are a kind of a mortar to the other housing programs and capital investments that are made in affordable housing. They're very necessary to get that housing built. We're net losing supply of affordable housing in the country. They're one of the only federal initiatives, not the only, but one of them that makes these affordable housing deals work, and they're on the chopping block.
Nan Roman, I wish we had more time to talk, but thank you very much for joining us this morning.
Thank you so much for having me.
Nan Roman is president and CEO of the National Alliance to End Homelessness. It's a public education, advocacy, and capacity-building organization. The Alliance identified and promoted innovative strategies for ending homelessness, many of which have been adopted by communities across the country. This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported HPR2 Hawaii Public Radio. It's now 8:14. Coming up, can a theater coexist with homeless people? Now, though, your backyard quiz.
In today's backyard quiz, we're taking a look at a homeless individual who attracted the attention of several media outlets back in May of this year. John Cruz, often referred to as Mango Man, had been seen for decades with lengthy dreadlocks and more recently with a walker to help him move around. Those who've spoken to him report that he is kind, in his late 60s, and is a veteran who served in the Vietnam War. He gained media attention when a group of residents in the community where he lives banded together to try to help him. In April of this year, a group of residents went to surprise him with a new walker and found him to be ill and in desperate need of health care. These concerned residents asked Dr. Chad Koyanagi, a local psychiatrist, to help them get Cruz the health care he needed. Koyanagi was able to put together a team to find him and get him the help he needed, and the story was a demonstration of how a community can work together to help a person in need. For today's quiz, we're wondering if you can tell us which Oahu community John Cruz, a.k.a. Mango Man, would frequent. FYI, it's the same community that banded together to try to help him. Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets the T-shirt.
Hi, good morning. I'm Andy Morishita from the University of Hawaii at Manoa. You're listening to The Conversation on HPR, Hawaii Public Radio. Join the conversation on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation.
Kumukahua is a downtown Honolulu theater with a long-standing commitment to the community at large. And as such, it has found a way to coexist with the growing homeless population around its Merchant Street facility. It can be a challenge, especially as the downtown numbers grow, but as Kumukahua Managing Director Donna Blanchard told us the other day, a community arts organization has a special obligation.
Because of our proximity to Chinatown, we have a certain amount of influx that we get at the theater here, and we've had occasions to have to ask people to leave because we're having a reception or we're getting ready for a show. Most of the homeless people, it's sort of a neighborhood of homeless people, and most of them understand what's going on here, and they are respectful of our timeline. Right here in front of the theater, we'll go weeks without seeing anyone, but when we come in the morning, there's a pile of cardboard that we need to clean up and move. We have had some people come here who are newer to the neighborhood and don't know who we are, and those are the ones that we'll have to ask them to move. I've come by the theater late at night and found people. I've had to ask them to move just so I could get into the door at the theater. And we also have, this is a little more funny, I guess, if a story about homeless people can be. There's a woman who very often sleeps in a doorway on the opposite side of our building, of our main entrance, and very often actors have to run around to enter from a door on that side to make specific entrances on our stage. And there's a very nice woman who sleeps back there sometimes, and just have to ask her to move. She's respectful. She doesn't come into the building, but she likes that doorway.
But the story you're telling me, Donna, is a whole story of kind of you want to be in a neighborhood. You want to be in Chinatown, but kind of there's a need to coexist with other communities in that neighborhood, right?
Right. These are people who live here just the same as we work here. This is their neighborhood.
That's difficult for a lot of people in society at large to accept, but that's kind of the conclusion you folks have come to?
Yeah, we have on our property, we are obligated, because we're in a state-run building, we are obligated to call the sheriff and let them know when we see people here, and they come, and they are always very polite about asking people to leave. So we do let them know when that's the case. But you know, they come right back, and they're here when we're not in the building. And we've never had any problems from these people. Now, that homeless population is different than occasionally we will have someone come by the theater who is clearly has something going on, either mentally or there are drugs in their system, and they can be unruly. That's something completely different. That's not what we experience on a day-to-day basis.
And one of the things that you're pointing out, Donna, is that the term homeless is not a monolithic one, that it's very hard to apply that to everyone, because you referred to the ones that you see regularly as a kind of a neighborhood unto themselves, yeah?
Right. Yeah, and they're not terribly social. I don't usually see these people chatting with each other. But they're members of society. You know, they're polite. They can respond. You know, if I say, you know, if you stay here, I have to call the sheriff. Every now and then we see people who are still here in the morning, and I let them know I'm going to have to call the sheriff. And usually they'll just go off on their own. I have no idea where they go.
Sheriff, as opposed to HPD, because of the state affiliation?
Yes. Yeah.
So that becomes a sheriff's kuleana. But at the same time, it has to have changed kind of the way your day-to-day operations feel, making that part of that's part of your daily responsibility then.
Yeah, we are. You know, this was something very new to me when I moved here. I came from the Chicago area, and the population is just not the same. There is a homeless population there, but it's just not the same. There, you know, you don't see a host culture there. You don't see Potawatomi Indians saying, "I have as much right to this land as you do." There, here, there are people who I believe feel that, and for whatever reasons, they are without a roof over their head right now. There is I feel, and I think that I've been taught to feel since I've been here, that it's logical to have a certain amount of respect for those people.
Mm-hmm. And that's a very different kind of a take on the whole situation. At once being without a place to live, and yet having a sense of proprietorship almost. Yeah.
Yeah. Yes.
Well, it's just it's an ongoing sort of awkward position to be in, and for a theater, you know, in the arts, you're inclined toward compassionate solutions by nature as artists, right?
Well, yeah. I think that's one of the beautiful things about art. Theater, in particular, is I've played roles that are people who do and say things I would never do and say. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't dream of doing and saying those things personally, me, Donna. Mm-hmm. But it helps you to understand what might be going on in someone else's head and to really think about taking a walk in someone else's shoes. We have a neighborhood of people here who walk their dogs in the little park beside our theater. Mm-hmm. And we've had people from Harbor Court here ask if we will stay on the ball and make sure that we're calling the sheriff whenever we see people there, because they don't want to bring their dog here for a walk at 11 o'clock at night and have to worry whether or not the person who's sleeping on our lanai is just houseless or is someone with a drug problem.
And you're seeing a real distinction in those populations.
We do, and it becomes more and more apparent, I think, the longer that I'm here. You can tell as soon as you look someone and they look back at you, whether or not they're really in there or there's a veil of drugs in between you and them.
Donna Blanchard is the managing director of Kumukahua Theater.
Outraged GOP debaters say things are bad while the president leads with optimism.
At a time of significant global volatility, we remain the world's safest, smartest investment.
But the rubber hits reality road when the Federal Reserve makes a decision on interest rates. Next time on The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International.
This morning at 9, right after The Conversation.
Hawaii's ACLU says the city sweeps of homeless people has violated the Constitution. Yesterday, the group filed a class action lawsuit to prevent future sweeps. Civil Beat reporter Chad Blair has today's reality check. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann.
Just as we thought maybe things were moving in a different direction, but you know, the family that we saw up there with Dan Gluck from the ACLU is a family that we have seen continually show up in a lot of media reports. So why are they saying that they're doing this lawsuit now?
Well, the ACLU cites the Constitution of the United States, the Fourth Amendment that's on unreasonable search and seizure, and also the 14th Amendment on equal protection. And the ACLU argues that when the city seizes and then destroys the belongings of these people, including the woman and her child that you're referring to, there's a photo of them on our website right now, that they really are in violation, and this is something that they should not be able to do. We're talking, by the way, about things like sleeping bags and tents, food, even identification that they have on them, things that they need to survive. Particularly identification. If you want to get a job or do just about anything that requires some sort of authorization, you need to have identification. So the ACLU wants the city to stop these sweeps, which are based on two city ordinances.
The sweeps have been going on for a while, and my understanding is that this is really looking back over our shoulder at the sweeps that have already happened. So why the lawsuit now as opposed to then? Was there any discussion
as you know, the city has recently started. They weren't sweeping Kaka'aka. Remember, they were doing it, and then the mayor said, let's take a break from doing that.
Right, and on September 8th, they started it again, right?
Exactly. They were doing the outskirts, and I believe there was another one scheduled for today. The ACLU would like to have the court impose that. We are talking, by the way, not about the sit-lay laws, but about the stored property and sidewalk nuisance ordinances. These are the things that allow authorities to go in and take away items that are left on the streets. They can do it in two ways. They can determine that it's a nuisance and take them away immediately, or they can give away a 24-hour notice, which has been the practice.
With the sweep that happened on the 8th, that one was seemingly well publicized. They'd been talking about it at the governor's team.
They posted signs in Kaka'ako.
They had people walking around giving notices. And also, according to the mayor, they were giving them, you know, bags to put their property that would be real important, like medicine and documents and all of that.
So, medicine, good example.
So how does that sync with the lawsuit going forward if some of those efforts have been done? I know the city says it's going to fight this tooth and nail.
Right. The city corporate council feels confident that similar ordinances have been upheld in other jurisdictions. But the ACLU says, well, not necessarily. They point to a case in Los Angeles in 2012 in which the court cited in particular the 4th and 14th Amendments. So they feel that there's some precedent here. The ACLU attorney really argues that what you're doing is you're placing an impossible burden on these people to meet and to get their belongings back. Well, of course, you can't get them back if they've been destroyed.
Exactly. All right, we'll be watching this case. Thanks very much for the update.
Thanks, Beth Ann.
Chad Blair reports for Civil Beat.
Support for The Conversation comes from Matson, proud to help fund construction of the American Cancer Society's Hope Lodge in Hawaii, a place for Hawaii's cancer patients and their caregivers to stay. Learn more about Matson's giving at matson.com. Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the Honolulu Board of Water Supply, protecting and managing Oahu's drinking water resources. Learn 7 ways to save water at boardofwatersupply.com.
Tonight at 5, Beth Ann, you'll be bringing us Town Square, and we'll get a chance to talk to the local service providers,
Exactly. We're bringing together Greg Payton, who is with Partners in Care, who heads that, Sheila Beckham from Waikiki Health, and Scott Fujii from Focus. He's now the interim director now that Scott Morishige has gone to work with the governor. And we're going to talk to them about how they've been assessing a lot of what we've been hearing this week through the various community and national voices we've talked to, and also what obviously they've been doing over a very long time and how they've been integrating the best practices that maybe some of us don't know about. And we're going to talk about why those best practices are what they are.
Well, we've certainly heard a variety of perspectives this week. You know, there's plenty of food for thought been generated,
A lot of it. And where all the conversation is going, though, trying to streamline that into a real strategy to be able to handle homelessness on lots of different fronts. As you heard Nan Roman say, you know, there's not a lot of resources there. There aren't for families. There aren't for youth. Distinct populations that we're dealing with, certainly, looking at that, the lawsuit that's front and center this morning, dealing with family and others. But we're going to take a look and see how all of that plays in and where we go from here as the service providers see it.
That's going to be the question, where we go from here. Tonight at 5 on Town Square. Thanks, Beth Ann.
That's where we're going.
Good morning. I'm Von Baron from the Honolulu Jazz Quartet. You're listening to The Conversation on HPR2, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
Over this week, we're talking with communities and national voices to see what they see when they consider Hawaii's homelessness situation and what context their experience can give our state. So far, most of the discussion has centered on veteran and chronic homelessness. Many communities we've spoken with are part of several national initiatives to end veteran homelessness by the end of this year and chronic homelessness by December 31st, 2016. Now, though, some input on the response to youth and family homelessness. As in Hawaii, housing costs in Oregon's Multnomah County have increased in recent years. According to the 2015 point-in-time count, Multnomah County, which includes Portland, has a deficit of 24,845 housing units affordable to lowest income renters, which often includes families and youth transitioning out of foster care and youth who, for a variety of reasons, find themselves on the streets. Mary Lee is the director of the Community Services Division and the Community Action Director for Multnomah County. She joins us now by phone. Good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks very much for being with us today.
Yes.
We're often told that identifying homeless youth is one of the most difficult aspects of reaching out to people who are homeless. I talked with one older teen who said that she was so embarrassed by her homelessness, she didn't want anybody to know, and she just tried to, as she put it, blend in. In 2013, though, the Department of Housing and Urban Development said for the first time that communities needed to capture a youth count of unaccompanied homeless youth up to age 24. Mary, if getting quantifiable data on homeless youth is relatively new and still so difficult to get, how can communities really develop effective strategies and best practices to work with youth and families?
Well, I think the first thing that we have learned about doing that is that we have to have an intention to do it. And when I say we have to have an intention, that has to be government, the private sector, law enforcement, child welfare, all of the various systems that potentially touch the life of a young person once they're on the street. And we have to come together and say, what is our intent to work in this arena and to try to serve this population? From there, what we have learned and what we've experienced here in Portland and Multnomah County is everything else falls out from there. So even when there are differences of opinion about why children become homeless or, you know, what's the best strategy, we were able to all come around a single value, which is none of us wants kids living on the street for whatever reason. And focusing there where we had agreement made it possible to figure out what we were going to do next. The other thing I would say is there's a difference in trying to figure out where you find young people in order to count them and demographically survey them. It's a different thing altogether where you have a staff person working in a relationship-based model who's doing outreach because they want to connect with that young person and help them figure out what they need and where to get it. We have an undercount of homeless youth in our point-in-time count that we're quite aware of, and we try to do different strategies around that. We do not have an undercount nor a problem in finding homeless youth with whom to engage over a period of time about what they want, what they need, and how they can do it. One story we have is a young woman who's now one of our peer advocates said that for at least 6 months, the only thing she would take from an outreach worker was a cotton swab. She didn't want to hear about services, she didn't want to talk about them, but she wanted a cotton swab. And so for 6 months or more, this outreach worker would find her and give her cotton swabs. That was the doorway, quite frankly, into the work she does now as a member of our oversight committee and as a peer mentor in the system. So I would say think about those two things differently, counting for what purpose or contacting for what purpose.
Taking the first part first, bringing together all of those folks who work with youth from law enforcement to government, child welfare, all of them. How did you do that? How did you get them to align a vision that said we're going to go out there and work on this together?
Well, again, we tried to look at what we could find to agree upon about the situation rather than focusing on what those differences were and trying to resolve them, which doesn't mean that we don't still have them and we don't bump knees and have to work on them all the time. But when we formed our relationships based on what were our shared values and where we agreed, so again, this thing of nobody thinks that it's ever okay for whatever reason for a child to be homeless and on the street, and what we want for these children is exactly what we want for each of our own children. And those were the two measuring sticks that we then went into a conversation about what does services look like, what is outcomes that we're driving towards, how do we reallocate resources. All of those stemmed from there.
Going now to the other part of it, when you're talking about actually being able to outreach to youth, and you mentioned that you've got an undercount. The count that we saw in the point-in-time count says about 300 or maybe 266. How many more youth do you feel you see out there that you service?
Well, our providers will say they believe that anywhere between 1,500 to 2,000 young people are homeless and on the streets in Multnomah County, and that does not include those young people who are couch surfing or who are you know, sort of marginally. They're home sometimes, they're housed sometimes, they're housed, you know, sometimes they're not. In our system, we serve about 1,200 young people a year with outreach and engagement services, and then from there, about 1,000 get deeper intensity services.
Now, earlier this morning when we talked to Nan Roman from the National Alliance to End Homelessness, she told us that there are not many resources for families and youth and that there are threats to funding for federal housing programs. She also mentioned that the inventory for low-income affordable rentals has been decreasing. If funding is cut and units continue to decrease, what do you see for homeless families and youth in the next few years?
I am greatly hopeful about what we have been able to do and what we're going to do, and I hope for other places in the country as well. You know, our system is based in a relationship with each other, with the funding sources, with the young people themselves. And even if there's $1 of resource that we're able to put towards this problem, we need to make sure that that dollar is being spent well, that we have a clarity of focus, that we have an alignment of our values and outcomes so that that $1, even if it's just $1, gets spent well. Now, what I can tell you is in our, you know, rental market, which is, you know, in the 2-3% vacancy rate, and our families and young people are not attractive renters because of their rental history, sometimes their debt, we are able to find and maintain housing for both families with children and homeless youth. Last fiscal year, in fiscal year 15, we housed almost 400 families into permanent housing. And that's a family a day we placed into housing. And at 12 months after we stopped serving them with rent assistance, over 90% of them were still housed. So in our tight rental market, with the lack of resources we have, all of which are very true barriers, I'm not discounting them at all, we are still able, because of our approach and our laser focus on what we're trying to do, to place significant numbers of families and have them stick.
And that seems to be the real lesson for Hawaii. Do you see anything else that you would pointedly tell Hawaii to take a look at?
You know, this has been my learning for us, is that Hawaii's problems will be solved by Hawaiians, and that by focusing on the values of the community and the people whom you're trying to serve and finding your areas of commonality and then continuing to hold yourself accountable to those values, I don't know that you can't help but be successful, even with, you know, a law enforcement perspective that says that we have to, you know, address these issues of law enforcement. And people will say, you can't do housing first, or people who would say, you can't put people into, you know, whatever the things we know we can't do, all of them can be managed through a focus on values and a continued sort of a relentless approach to hope. Research shows that hope is one of the most important predictive factors in whether or not behavior will change. And while we leverage that in an individual approach with a young person or a family and the service worker, we've also got to leverage that for ourselves as members of the community and as government and the other sectors that are working on this issue. We have to have hope and believe that we can make the difference. And oddly enough, when we do that, that's what happens.
It becomes almost a self-fulfilling prophecy. Thank you so much for the time this morning.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Good to talk to you. Mary Lee is the director of the Community Services Division and the Community Action Director for Multnomah County, Oregon.
Support for today's programming comes from Manoa Valley Theater, presenting the Hawaii premiere of In the Next Room, or The Vibrator Play, a Victorian-era comedy about marriage and intimacy. On stage now through October 4th, ManoaValleyTheater.com.
In this morning's Backyard Quiz, we focused our attention on a homeless individual who attracted the attention of several media outlets in May of this year. John Cruz, also known as Mango Man, has been around Oahu for decades, associated with his lengthy dreadlocks and a walker to help him move around. Concerned residents found help for him from Dr. Chad Koniagi, a local psychiatrist, and helped find him the health care he desperately needed. Dr. Koniagi put together a team that tracked him down and offered him help, And the story is an example of how a community can work to help a person in need. We asked you the name of that community, and the answer is Kailua on Oahu's east side.
And Richard Velasquez knew the answer and also called in from Kailua, and we'll be sending you the t-shirt. Thanks so much for joining us on the Backyard Quiz this morning with your answer. And if you've got a quiz for us, you know, you can send it in. Our address is talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Achieve 3000's Home Edition, an online tool designed for parents to strengthen the school-home connection by creating continuity between classwork and homework. Achieve3000.com/HawaiiParents.
No one needs to tell Mayor Billy Kanoi that Hawaii Island has the highest rate of poverty, or that since 2013. This year's point in time count figures shows that there's been a 123% escalation of homeless people. It's especially telling to see the number of unsheltered swell to a little over 1,000 people, while the sheltered population stayed relatively constant at about 200. This week, we've been hearing the reactions from Hawaii's mayors to the guests we've been speaking with and communities around the country and national voices on homelessness. Mayor Billy Kanoi, it's your turn. Thank you for joining us today.
Aloha, Bethann. Thank you for having me.
Now, a clear theme that we've had this week is that it's crucial to bring together all the parts of a community. You just heard that again when we talked to Mary Lee. Government, private organizations, service providers, enforcement, to look at how much homelessness really costs and to be able to create that shared vision and to see maybe how you might divide the pot a little differently of the cost to create more low-income permanent rentals and just to be able to do it more effectively. Mayor Carvalho says that he'd like to bring housing first to Kauai, and he'd like to work through the faith-based communities. Mayor Caldwell says he already supports housing first and would be in favor of more, perhaps more business and tourism dollars to create additional permanent housing. On the other hand, Mayor Arakawa told us yesterday that he doesn't think housing first is something that would work on Maui. He says Maui needs more shelter space, and he wants the Department of Health to step up with more services. That brings us to you. How do you respond to those who say housing first is literally the key to countering homelessness?
Well, Bethann, I would just say that there are a lot of opportunities to implement successful models, housing first being one of them. I think what housing first does, and a lot of programs that are comprehensive in scope and implementation, is that homelessness is a very complex issue. It's not about shelters or roofs or construction of units. We know that our chronically homeless sometimes are categorized as two diagnoses, meaning there's mental health issues as well as substance abuse issues involved. We know there's vocational and educational components to it. We know it's more than housing, that there's actually a sustainable lifestyle, usually needing thorough, comprehensive case management to provide a myriad of services. And that's why when people talk about answers to homelessness, you know, there isn't a magic bullet. There isn't a simple answer or a simple solution or a cookie-cutter approach that what works here will work there. What communities do have to do, and I aloha all of my fellow mayors, we've all met recently. We meet regularly. We all met with the governor and his a homeless task force, including the leaders in the legislature and staff members throughout the state. But what we do know is this, that it's going to take everyone's commitment and dedication. It's going to take collective effort. It's going to take certainly cooperation and collaboration. But also, like you said, you know, we have multidisciplinary teams in East and West Hawaii on Hawaii Island that works out of our prosecutor's office that meets monthly to coordinate all the service providers to connect homeless people with housing and social services. We have health assessment outreach teams both in East and West Hawaii. You'll hear me reference that because, of course, Hawaii Island, for listeners who aren't aware, is 4,028 square miles. So we're covering an island the size of the state of Connecticut. Which requires programs and services and initiatives on two sides instead of in just one place.
Well, I mean, and that's part of it, that Hawaii Island looks very different, which is one of the reasons why we kind of saved you for last, because you have a different approach to it because of the sheer territory you have to cover. But if Housing First is part of the answer, as well as other models that you've seen, what's your best strategy for going forward, knowing that you've got so many different populations of homeless folks to be able to help?
Well, we're certainly working off of the Housing First model, because it addresses the situation exactly where it is. You know, we cannot work with a homeless population that we wish we had. We have to work with those in need exactly where they are. And Housing First is an initiative and a model that allows us to go straight in and tackle the challenge that we're confronted with daily, instead of putting it off for strategic planning or long-range planning. I think we see it more stark in urban Honolulu, but it's the same situation in Hilo and Kona. And that's going in on a daily basis, identifying those in need and getting them the help they need as quickly and as soon as possible. And that's what Housing First allows.
Do you have enough units, though, to be able to actually put people into supportive housing?
No, we do not have what's called the absorptive capacity to take everybody into the housing. We have built in the last 7 years an emergency shelter in West Hawaii, because that's where housing is most acute. We do work with our social service providers to see what kind of availability they have. We built a 94-unit transitional housing program, because homelessness isn't just getting somebody in a house, right? There's an entire spectrum of housing that needs to be provided. On one end of the spectrum is emergency housing, getting somebody off of the street into someplace clean, or take a shower, have a safe place to put their head down at night. If they have families, put them in a safe environment, then identify, do a thorough assessment, and get them and connect them.
Right, you're talking about a conduit.
Right. But then there's a next step, and that's transitional housing. And we have a 94-unit, again, in West Hawaii that we just built that allows people a little longer-term stay, some from 90 days up to 2 years. And that's a transitional program. That's where we're at. We also have incentives in our Hawaii County tax code that allows incentives for affordable housing. Mm-hmm. What that does is it incentivizes homeowners, second homeowners, that if you own a second home, you pay the highest rate of taxes, about $10, in excess of $10 per $100,000 in valuation. But if you provide that housing into an affordable rental, as defined by HUD, 70% of the median income of an area, mm-hmm. that you get to pay $5.55 instead.
So Mayor, because we're going to have to leave you for a moment here, I wanted to ask you very quickly, though.
Yeah.
When we're talking a lot about chronic homelessness and veteran homelessness, there's a lot of attention going there. As we heard this morning, not so much when it comes to youth homelessness and families. Is there anything specific that you can tell us about Hawaii Island when you look at families and youth homelessness?
Well, you know, what we find when we talk youth, when we talk about youth homeless, it's that transition age. You know, some who might be in a foster family, they reach 18 and they get out. And that 18 to early 20 gap group who might not have the resources or the skills to acquire, mm-hmm. secure, and maintain housing on their own. There's certainly a challenge that we don't have an answer for that.
Okay.
Well, that's
okay.
Families,
I mean, just the fact that we're
targeting families and getting our children in healthy, safe environments as quickly as possible, and that's our priority.
All right. Thank you so much for the time that you gave us this morning. We'll be talking about this more in future.
Oh, okay. Thank you, Bethann. And thanks for highlighting a very important, critical issue. And I just want to leave it one thing, that we've got to remember that homelessness isn't something we can just sweep off our streets, that, you know, it's not a crime. People who our challenge need to be treated with respect, compassion, and dignity. And I'd like to commend everybody working on the issue, because I believe they're all coming from that place of aloha, kindness, respect, and compassion.
Thank you so much. Mayor Billy Kanoi is the mayor of Hawaii County.
Is all we ever say? Butter everything, yeah. No counsel they can take from us, ground at which we stay.
land of the free, we still pay. Still low, a moon and sun day with you. Just to see the stars.
Support for The Conversation comes from PBS Hawaii, presenting Canefield Songs, Hole Hole Bushi, a documentary hosted by Jake Shimabukuro, 9 o'clock tonight. Learn more at pbshawaii.org.
That's going to do it for us for today. Coming tomorrow, our last day of our series, we'll talk with Lloyd Pendleton, who is the state coordinator on homelessness from Utah. And we'll be speaking with Jennifer Ho, the senior advisor on housing and services at HUD. And the state's homelessness administrator, Scott Morshige, will be here. That's what's up for tomorrow. You've got something on your platter, too, there.
We do, indeed. There's a program for medical students who reach out to the homeless population with a student-run free clinic. So it seems a good way to wrap up what we're talking about this week.
Indeed, and we will. In the meantime, as you may have heard through various spots on HPR 1 and 2, the early bird campaign is in full swing, and we are asking for your early bird pledges, and there are some very special incentives attached to some of that, including Hawaiian miles and other good things. You can call us at 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 to make your pledge of support and see if we might be able to decrease the overall time that we will spend with on-air pledging in a couple of weeks. We want to thank Santo DiMartino calling in from Eva Beach and Thomas J. Smith from Pepe Akeo and Patty Kelleher from Kapa'a for calling in with pledges of support. We have had so far 212 pledges. Maybe you could be the 213th. Thanks so much for all your support of Hawaii Public Radio. We will see you back here tomorrow. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich.
And I'm Chris Vanderkirk.
Join us tomorrow for The Conversation right here on Hawaii Public Radio. We'll see you then.